Well, the primary responsibility there to track is taking care of the spectators. You know, with 300,000 plus spectators, we would see 180, 200 plus spectators in the track hospital. And, you know, anywhere from two drivers to maybe 15 at most, I think that was in 1992. But the majority of the care there is providing for the spectators from cuts and bruises and intoxication.
I hear there's alcohol there.
You know, they serve a lot of beer, that's for sure.
What does happen at a summer festival? What's the most unusual thing you've ever had to deal with?
I mean, there's always fights and things of that nature, but the intelligence is lowered sometimes as the alcohol level increases.
An inverse relationship.
Can you imagine that? And, you know, so you can have some contest of who can break the most bottles with their foot, you know, without getting cut, things like that.
It is a summer festival.
Okay, absolutely.
The start of summer. You were a track physician for about 12 years. Did things change in the nature of the event over that period?
You know, they really did, Charlie. Back in about 82, 83, there was a lot of variation in the cars. You remember the Cosworth engines and Offenhausers and Fords and Pontiac engines, and the noise was different. The cars were engineered differently. During that time period, I saw a lot of changes from drivers getting a lot of foot injuries because of the way they were positioned in the car and the way the cars were engineered. And over time, they built the car so that energy would be dissipated away from feet, and you don't get as many feet injuries as you used to back then.
Cars are going faster now.
You know, they are. I think Hinchcliffe this weekend, 230-plus, that is really moving. And I think the downforce effects of the cars they've engineered allow them to just really kind of suck to the track. And it's quite amazing.
James Hinchcliffe is the pole winner for the 100th Indianapolis 500 that you just mentioned there. You mentioned downforce. What are you talking about there?
Well, that's when the car is moving. You know, some of them have the big wings, and the way they're engineered, the wind actually pushes down on the car, and also the underneath almost kind of causes a suction, if you will. So it's a fine balance there, and you'll see them sometimes changing the wings to decrease or the downforce or increase the downforce.
That enables them to go faster, even in the turns. But in the turns, there's are sideways G-forces. What's the impact of that on drivers?
Well, it's quite amazing. It's like almost being a fighter pilot, where the Valsalva maneuvers, where you hold your breath or and pressure that you maintain your consciousness, if you will, as you go around.
Valsalva maneuvers?
It's kind of holding your breath and grunting, if you will. The most dynamic, if you've ever seen the inside the cockpit of, say, the Blue Angels, you'll hear them grunting as they make a turn, and that's part of that process of keeping the pressure, in good shape.
And the reason for that is to maintain the blood flow to their extremities?
And their head. They want to keep the brain, keep them conscious.
How pronounced are the G-forces in Indy cars?
You know, they're very pronounced. If they hit the wall, if you remember Gordon Smiley died, they reckoned that the G-forces were 320 Gs, and almost every bone in his body was broken during that time. It's pretty amazing.
How are cars engineered to reduce the likelihood that somebody becomes like that?
They fall apart, and when they fall apart, they dissipate the injury. That allows the energy to not be transferred to the driver, and that makes all the difference in the world.
So it's like putting a knife blade to a grinding wheel. It just sort of ablates off.
It does. When you look at them, all of a sudden the wheels are flying, the tub's just shattered, and everything around it takes that energy away, whereas probably in the early 60s, 50s, blunt force trauma, you know, was causing the most injuries because everything was transferred right to the driver.
Even with this technology to remove the force of impact little by little through the fragmentation of the car, you still have a high risk of concussion if there's an accident. What have you seen?
Well, I think the way that the helmets have been engineered have been very, very good. I think the harnesses that the drivers wear that stabilize their head and prevent some of the thrashing about makes a big difference. When drivers would come in after a race, we used to check their helmets, and you'd actually see, you'd feel on the inside to see if there was any areas that were compacted that would absorb that energy. And if they had, that helmet was no longer usable since the impact absorbing material would lose its effectiveness.
There's been a lot of attention in recent years placed on cumulative concussion damage to the brains of football players. Would you anticipate that becoming an issue in future years among race car drivers as well?
That's probably an absolute. I did some research and looking at response time back in the mid-80s to see what the baseline was for a driver. And then looking at any change post-race after an accident. Never took it anywhere, but the basic premise was that these people were suffering concussions. And I think that I haven't read anything recently, but it sure makes sense to me that, when a car is stopping in a very short distance at 200 miles an hour, that that's very concerning for concussive injury. I think they used to talk about Danny Ungaias and Gordon Johncock and some of those guys having concussions from the amount of accidents that they had and how it affected their driving careers.
With engine technology and anything designed to make the car perform better, there is a great deal of proprietary feeling about that, and things tend to be kept secret. With safety technology, I would hope that it would be spread rather rapidly. Did you find that to be the case?
I really did. Probably one of the pioneers at the time, I believe, was Bill Simpson and his Nomex driver's suits, the helmets that he would engineer, the Haas traction device for helmets, shoulders, all those things they shared, and then they become standard. You have to have those things as part of your car.
What do those things do?
It would prevent you from being thrown out of the car, for one. It prevents you from being moved around. You'll find that most race car drivers, when they are strapped in a car, they are strapped so solidly that they really can't move. I mean, they can breathe, but the last thing they want to be able to be bounced around inside the car at 200 miles an hour on the track.
Do they get bruised anyway, even if they don't crash?
They can. I mean, their knees can bounce against each other inside the tub. Ankles, shoulders, they can be pretty sore after a long race.
What kinds of injuries do race car drivers get just from sitting there, even if they're successful ones? You mentioned the bruising.
I think the bruising probably is the main part that, we saw. Maybe some chafing if their clothes didn't fit right, but otherwise they were pretty unscathed. The seats are actually formed to them, so they actually fit their body types. And it's in some of the races, like in the 24 hours of Sebring, sometimes they'll actually change the seating to fit the contour of the driver, and so they're form fitted.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Jim Nevin, a physician at Advocate Broman Medical Center. He's the vice president of medical management there, but he also served as a track physician at the Indianapolis 500 from 1983 to 1995. We often think of the stereotypical race car driver as somebody out of the era of prohibition, you know, where you're a good old boy and you're rolling the hills and hollers. But how athletic are these people?
It's truly amazing. Tony Kanaan was rated as one of the most fit athletes during his time back in 2012, I think. You know, perform triathlons. They really do train a lot more, really a lot more. Helio Castroneves, a phenomenal athlete. Body types have changed a little bit since A.J. Foyt.
Yeah? What do they have to have now in terms of eyes, in terms of fast twitch, slow twitch, in terms of concentration? What are the qualities necessary for this kind of athlete?
Depth perception and vision is critical. When you're moving that fast, you know, you are looking where you're going to go and anticipating and preparing for that. Probably part of it also is knowing not to twitch. They speculate on Gordon Smiley, I mentioned earlier, had been a dirt car driver, and he crashed in, it was 1982. He tried to correct his back end of the car, let loose. And so the correction for a dirt car driver is you turn into the slide. And when he turned in, the car just got traction and he hit head on into the wall. Whereas drivers nowadays would actually, if they back end started going out, they might actually accelerate into it and drive through that process rather than trying to correct it.
Note to self, cross-disciplinary stuff, not so easy.
Correct.
Okay. As a track physician, what do you have to prepare to do for drivers when they come in?
First off, all the track physicians at the Indy 500 are emergency medicine board certified physicians or residents in training. So they've been through advanced trauma life support. One of the benefits that we would have in the track hospital is that you could actually see the crash on a closed circuit TV. So you would know what happened. You could see if somebody was hit maybe by flying debris, at what angle they hit the track, what side they might be hurt on, how difficult it was to get them out of the tub that they, you know, were crashed into. Then when they would come in, if they had to be extracted, we would cut off their racing uniforms to get to their feet and legs and wherever we needed to pay attention.
When you're watching and you see these various elements you just described, what pieces of information do those give you that can make a crucial difference in the first couple minutes when they come in?
You know, the first minutes really are probably provided on track by the EMS personnel. Stabilizing a driver's head, a neck, to prevent neck injury, making sure their airway is open if they get knocked unconscious. Those are critical aspects to it. Then being ready if there was injury that you needed to start IVs, prepare the helicopter if they were going to fly out. Just that quick thinking ahead. What do we need to do? You know, Zanardi, who lost both his legs in Europe, you know, they saw that happen and they were able to clamp down and prevent him from extenuating. Otherwise, you know, he would have died in any other accident in the world.
He would have bled out.
Absolutely.
What attracted you to the job of track physician in the first place?
Well, actually, I started as a medical student volunteering for the first aid tents all around the track. The Indiana University School of Medicine would provide medical students to provide that service. And I went from there to coordinating the medical students to then doing my residency in emergency medicine. And being part of that inner circle in emergency medicine, the cutting edge, really was intoxicating in its own way. It helps you see, you know, the greatest spectacle on earth from an inside position.
How did the inside look at it shape your appreciation of racing?
You know, the concentration, I think, that the drivers have to have, their awareness of their surroundings, the amount of trust that they have to have with fellow drivers. Probably the scariest part for the veteran drivers is coming up on rookie drivers that they don't know. For them to race each other, that they know each other, is a lot different than an unknown.
There have been some allegations that the world of racing still remains quite sexist. How does the level of trust differ between male drivers and somebody like Danica Patrick?
You know, when you look back, Janet Guthrie, Jill St. John, Danica Patrick, and now you have Pippa, they've won their right. I think that probably there was maybe some jealousy over the publicity and notoriety that someone that like Danica Patrick, who is very pretty and a good driver, if you will, her fame came a little quicker than someone, a male of equal driving experience would come.
So it's not necessarily gender related, but it is a dues-paying jealousy.
I think there is some of that. I think we find that almost in any sports in many ways, where somebody can come in that hasn't paid their dues and all of a sudden they're a superstar and they're all caught up in their own a press release. There becomes some jealousy or infighting with that.
In the course of your 12 years at the Brickyard, do you have favorite stories you'd like to share?
You know, probably the one that still stands out, and I actually have a picture of it, is the 92 race that was the one of the coldest races since about, I think, 1913. And you'll see I'm showing you nine helmets that were stacked up, and these are guys like Rick Mears, Fittipaldi, Sneva, John Cock, Lyondyke, the Andretti's, Guerrero. That was the Guerrero spun out on the parade lap, if you'll remember, trying to warm his tires up. So unfortunately, it stands out because we've had to take care of so many drivers at that time. And it was the closest race in history, 0.043 seconds or so between Scott Goodyear and Al Unser Jr. So
Nat's eyelash.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
You had mentioned the level of concentration required is quite formidable. How does then someone do what one driver is trying to do this year by completing a 600-mile race before coming to Indy and doing the 500-mile race in the same day?
You know, it blows my mind how they could do that. I know I think Jeff Andretti tried to do it. Tracy tried to do it. Just the exhaustion of the arms and the legs and concentration boggles my mind, quite frankly.
Other stories you'd like to share?
You know, the tradition, seeing guys like Al Unser Sr. and A.J. Foyt and Emerson Fittipaldi and Ari Lyondyke, how they changed. Johnny Rutherford, real personalities. And we used to, it was the entire month that the track community was there. We performed physicals on them, their vision, their hearing. And they got to know you, and they'd come in and talk with you, and it was a pretty neat little community at that time. And now I think that with less practice, only 1 weekend of qualifications, all the cars being about the same, it's almost like a jockey on a good horse, if you will. So
faster, but perhaps with less cultural affinity.
That's true.
We talked a lot about the car technology, but have the cars now made the track obsolete? The original camber of the Brickyard was laid down in 100 years ago.
Right.
It's been changed a little bit, but how much more does it need to be changed?
You know, when you compare Indy to tracks like the Daytona 500, where the banking is much more severe, I don't know that you can change that much more. It would become like Hot Wheels, I guess, if you had, that you could probably have them drive, completely parallel to the ground if with the speed they get, if their suspension and everything would, hold it at those speeds. I think the safer barriers that they put in the corners now, the foam dissipating, energy absorbing Safer Barrier is a phenomenal change that has been, you know, adopted at other racetracks, and I think it saved lives and prevented a lot of injuries.
Okay. Coming soon, the loop-de-loop at the Indianapolis
500. It could be.
Where is racing going? Every time we think we have seen the peak of it, something changes.
You know, it's hard to say. I really enjoyed when I first got involved with cars had some personality of the mechanics and the way they were set up, and that was really fun. And what they've done nowadays, where, you know, they're all Honda and Chevy engines, and the cars basically all look alike. I think they've got much fancier paint schemes this year, but it's kind of leveled the playing field where more people can be in it. It was being really monopolized by the big money. You look at Formula One, the millions and millions of dollars that are spent in that race venue are phenomenal. But what an experience! You know, you got cars that have RPMs go up 20,000 RPMs in 2 seconds, and the screaming noise from that is so much different than the noise from the, you know, Indy cars or from the NASCAR. So I think racing is here to stay. There's something about driving that we all can relate to, and I think people, the fans, still enjoy seeing passing. That's one thing I think that against the Formula One is there's very little passing. It's basically if you win the pole, you typically win the race. And it's sometimes that way with Indy cars, but it's hard to say. I think if they keep the beer cold and the cars fast, people will be excited to go.
Jim Nevin is the Vice President of Medical Management at Advocate Broman Medical Center in Normal and a former track physician at the Indianapolis 500 between 1983 and 1995. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.